Knowlton, the right-handed hitting left fielder. It's a righty-righty matchup. He comes from Central Michigan University. A couple of guys from Central Michigan. Nate Ross, the pitcher for the Woodchucks. Runner taking off. The pitch is low. Throw on down to second. In time again. A second caught stealing for Harrison Garrett. He continues to show off the arm defensively. And there's now two outs in the top of the ninth. 3-1 count to Zach Knowlton. Started off as a rough game for him. Made a couple of errors early on, but he's retired the last two runners caught stealing. So a 3-1 count now to Knowlton, and he swings and misses. Full count to Knowlton, who's trying to keep the inning alive and get some more insurance for the Woodchucks. Although they have a good lead, the Rafters have shown some explosiveness. Couple of big innings this year, and the 3-2 count now on the way home. Torres fires, and that one called low for ball number four. Back-to-back walks on full counts from Tony Torres, and it brings up Keegan Jerschle with a man on first and two away in the top of the ninth. Five-run Woodchucks lead. Jerschle, the right-handed hitting second baseman. It's a righty-righty matchup. Jerschle comes from South Dakota State. And this year, it's been a struggle for him at the plate, batting just 158, but he does have a hit this game. He's 1-for-4. First pitch on the way, called for strike number one, an 0-1 count. Reached on an error back in the seventh inning. He flew out before that and grounded out and singled his first time up. 0-1 the count, broken bat over to short, picked up, flipped 6-4, and that gets the fielder's choice to retire the ninth inning. On that inning, the Woodchucks pick up no runs, no hits, no errors, and one left on base. We go to the bottom of the ninth. The Rafters down 8-3. This is Rafters Baseball on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
I'm the threat that's already inside the house. In the closet, under the bed, in the car. But I don't want your money or your TV. I can't be scared away or negotiated with. I'm patient and quiet. I don't sleep. You can't call the cops on me. You can't even see me. I'm the threat of family fire. And as long as your guns aren't stored securely, I'll be there. Protect your family. Secure all your guns. Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. That's endfamilyfire.org. A public service announcement brought to you by Brady and the Ad Council.
It's the bottom of the ninth here from Witterfield, and the Rafters, they have their work cut out for them. Down five, it's an 8-3 Woodchucks lead, but the Rafters going to be facing a new pitcher, not the guy who went six up, six down. It's Tanner Goswick who takes over for Nate Ross. As I mentioned, I tell you what, Nate Ross, a very strong performance from him. He retired all six batters that he faced and did so on 27 pitches. He went two innings, did not allow a run, a hit, or a walk, and had one strikeout. Hands it off to Goswick, another right-hander on the mound. He faces Eric Harper, who fouls the first one, a liner down the right field line. 0-1 the count, and Harper 3-for-3 from the plate, all on singles, looking for hit number four. The Rafters haven't had a five-hit game. However, they have had a few four-hit games this year. 0-1 the count coming home, and Harper fouls it back. Now 0-2 the count. And Harper has been really looking good over these last few games. He's reached base multiple times, four consecutive games, including this one. He's got multiple hits in his last two, including this one. 0-2 count coming home, and it's a fly ball foul hit out of play down the right field side. So still an 0-2 count. And 0-2 count. Goswick looking to record his first out of the ninth inning. Pitch comes home, breaking ball. Called a little bit inside for ball number one. 1-2 the count. Good eye from Eric Harper, who's looking for his pitch. A guy from NOC Tonkawa who really hit the ball well in college during this spring. Took a couple of months off, though, before the second half started, as this one is a fly ball foul down the left field line. So it's seemingly taken him a little bit to get back into baseball form, but at NOC Tonkawa, I tell you what, this guy absolutely crushed the baseball. Bunch of home runs this past season and over 1,000 OPS. 1-2 count coming home. It's taken outside for ball number two. Did not miss by much there. Tough hold off from Eric Harper. And now a 2-2 count. Seventh pitch of the plate appearance coming up next from Tanner Goswick. He brings the ball into his glove and fires home. It's taken on the outside edge for strike number three, and Harper is retired for the first time this game. The Rafters have seen their last eight consecutive batters taken down. The last man to reach is the man at the plate, Hiroto Kobayashi, who singled his last time up back in the sixth inning. He is 1-for-3 on the game. He walked before that single as well, so he's reached multiple times today as he takes the first pitch for ball number one, a 1-0 count. Batting in the leadoff spot here, you haven't seen that all too much this season, but continuing to look strong, 1-0 count, misses low again, now 2-0 the count. Kobayashi has batted leadoff just twice this season. This is his third game in the leadoff spot. Royce Clayton Jr., though, as of late, he's been taking over that spot. 2-0 the count. It's a fly ball down the right field line in foul territory. It will reach out of play and bounce off of the roof for a foul ball. 2-1 the count. So Kobayashi really turning things around as of late, and you just love to see it. He hit his first home run of the season just a couple days ago at Fond du Lac. He had four extra base hits in that game. Three doubles and a dinger. Went 4-for-5 from the plate and also drew a walk. 2-1 the count on the way home, and he fouls this one back. And now a 2-2 count. Kareem Arusovic is on deck. He is due up in the bottom of the ninth. The Rafters still down 8-3 against the Wausau Woodchucks. The Woodchucks looking for win number 16 of the second half. 2-2 the count coming home. Gets a swing and a miss. Strike number three. And the Rafters down to their last out of the ninth inning. And with one more out, the Woodchucks will clinch a winning record in the second half. With barely over half of this second half done. This is their... would be their 16th win. They have three losses and one tie. So this would be game number 20 for them out of 32 as the first pitch to Kareem Arusovic misses low for ball number one. So with 12 games to play, the Woodchucks would already clinch a winning record. 1-0 the count to Arusovic. He's a left-handed hitting DH, lefty-righty matchup with Goswick on the mound, and he misses the second one inside for ball two. Now a 2-0 count. Arusovic 1-for-3 on the game. He struck out twice, but he's also walked once, and he sends one high in the air out towards right center field, going back to the warning track. Now slowing down at the wall. It is caught by the right fielder Malone, and that will end the game. A huge flyout from Kareem Arusovic, just shy of his first home run yet again. And that does it for the game. In the ninth inning, the Rafters no runs, no hits, no errors, and nobody left on base. Their last 10 batters were all retired in order as the Rafters fall 8-3 against the Woodchucks here at home. Not the way that the Rafters wanted things to go, but we'll have a breakdown of the game coming up for you in just a moment. The Rafters postgame show comes up next. Final score 8-3. We'll recap how it all happened, take a look at the stats, and look ahead to next game, all on the Rafters postgame here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party. You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our quinces. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I think the advice I would give is you don't need to know all the answers. The craziest thing was believing that your dad knew everything. So as a dad, you felt like you had to know everything. You had to get everything right. It's okay to make mistakes. As long as it's coming from love, then, you know, it kind of starts to work itself out. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
You can't escape a traffic jam. Know what else you can't escape? Seasonal allergies. And you might think you can avoid that coffee stain until... Oh, really? You can't escape a lot of things in life. But you can escape prediabetes. Prediabetes captures 1 in 3 adults. There are usually no signs of prediabetes. In fact, most people don't even know they have it. But with early diagnosis, you can change the outcome and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Take action by taking the 1-minute risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org. You might not be able to escape having this song stuck in your head, but you can escape prediabetes. Go to doihaveprediabetes.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Now, back to more Wisconsin Rapids Rafters baseball on WFHR.
And the Rafters postgame show coming your way here from Witter Field. The Rafters end up falling in that game 8-3, the final score. But, man, you're not going to take the Woodchucks down all too easily. That is a very good ball club, and they have continued to prove that. They have now won a ton of games in a row, and with that win, they improved to 16-3-1. It's their 7th straight win, and they just continue to dominate in the Northwoods League, looking for that playoff spot. They're trying to build the lead on the Madison Mallards, and, well, they're doing a good job of that here in the second half. Let's take a look back at the way that the game went. The Rafters are officially eliminated now from playoff contention with that loss, as the Woodchucks do extend their lead up to a 16-win season. The Rafters, no chance at getting 16 wins this season. That was their 17th loss of the second half, specifically second half when I say season. And so the Rafters, unfortunately, not going to be in the playoffs this year. But, well, they still have plenty to play for. All these guys are trying to improve and develop. And so you're looking kind of the rest of the way at seeing how well these guys can gel. And, of course, for guys like the coaching staff, Ziggy especially, trying to get things back on the right track here. And this is really where you can make things happen as the fireworks will come on here at Witterfield. So I'll turn down the crowd mic. But let's take a look back at how it all happened. First inning, the Woodchucks were able to take the lead, but it was an unearned run that went against Tristan Krusenberry as an RBI ground out for Max Solis sent home Christian Smith Johnson. That made it 1-0. The Rafters were able to score in the bottom of the first, but the Tekken comes and the Woodchucks score 4 runs. They 5 out of 6 batters to start off the inning. Singles, and that made it 4-run inning. 5-0 was the score. But bottom of the second, the Rafters are able to rally for a couple of hits of their own. They start off the inning with 3 straight hits, including an RBI single from Harrison Garrett, then an RBI from Royce Clayton Jr., and another single from Eric Harper. Although they weren't able to score anymore, they cut the lead down to 5-2. From that point on, it was a couple of scoreless innings, and then in the bottom of the fourth, the Rafters managed one more. It was a RBI walk with the bases loaded to Kareem Arusevic to make it a 5-3 ball game. Top of the fifth comes around, and the Woodchucks score yet again against Tristan Krusenberry. He was not quite able to go through 5 complete innings. He ended the game allowing 6 runs, 5 of them were earned over his 4 2/3 innings. After allowing an RBI single to Zach Knowlton, he was pulled, and Tyler Pacetti comes into the game and retires the only batter that he saw. After that point, the Rafters would go scoreless. They could not get the offense rolling. Zach Wyatt has a quality start. He goes 6 innings, allowing just 3 runs over those 6 innings. Although he did allow 10 hits, the Rafters just weren't able to bring home the runs. He had 6 strikeouts in the game as well. In the top of the seventh, that's when the next runs would come across from the Woodchucks. They scored 2 runs off of Tyler Pacetti. One of them was earned, one of them was unearned, as they saw 3 straight hits lead off the inning, then an RBI fielder's choice, and then an error sent home another run. That made it 8-3, and from that point on, no more runs would score. Tyler Pacetti able to have a very strong showing, and same with Tony Torres in the ninth inning, but Zach Wyatt, 6 innings. He was followed by Nate Ross in the seventh and eighth. Ross went 6 up, 6 down, and Tanner Goswick in the ninth inning, 3 up, 3 down with 2 strikeouts. Taking a look at the Rafters stats for the game, offensively, Kareem Arusevic reached twice. He went 1-for-4 with a walk. Along with that, Kobayashi 1-for-4 with a walk. He reached multiple times again. Luke Skinner had a double going 1-for-4. Harrison Garrett reached twice in the game, going 2-for-4 from the plate. He picked up hits number 2 and 3 in his Rafters career. And along with that, Eric Harper, a 3-for-4 game from the plate, although he was not able to drive in a run or an RBI himself. So that was the offensive numbers. Taking a look at the pitching side of things, Krusenberry went 4 2/3 innings, and he had allowed 10 base runners. Tyler Pacetti, though, over 3 1/3 innings, he allowed just 1 earned run on 3 hits and 1 walk. He did strike out 2 batters as well. And Tony Torres, he did walk 2 batters, but didn't allow a hit or a run in his 1 inning pitch. Also didn't have a strikeout. But that's a look back at all the stats and numbers from the game. Taking a look up next, the Rafters are going to travel to Green Bay to take on the Rockers for the first of a 2-game weekend series. And the righty Trevor Moik going to be on the mound for the Rafters as he is looking to continue his last start where he went 4 1/3 innings and allowed just 1 earned run while striking out 6. He'll be going up against Matt Crowley for the Rockers. That's a look at tomorrow's matchup. It's an afternoon game, 1:05 p.m. start time here in Central Time Zone, which means a 12:50 pregame start. Looking forward to that one and hope to have you along with us. But that's about all for our broadcast here tonight. The Rafters end up dropping it 8-3, and a couple of shout-outs have to be given, as always, to the coaching staff for always being open and available to talk to. Along with that, a big shout-out to all my coworkers here at Wisconsin Rapids for helping make my job easier and making things great. Along with that, a big shout-out, as always, to the folks at WFHR and Chuck Gennaro for always engineering us and making sure that we get on the air. We're He was a big help to making sure that we got live at the start of the game here and able to get things back on the air. So big shout out to him, as always. And one final shout out to our pregame guest, Harrison Garrett, for joining us on the show. But the Rafters, one last time, final score, the Rafters 3, the Woodchucks 8. From myself, Austin Thomas, and from the rest of the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters, thank you, and have a phenomenal, amazing, great rest of your night.
Vote for this bill to cut Medicaid. You have to respond quickly in order to get in on the media cycle. And in order to do that, there's certain approaches. And above all, what I think you'd agree with is people are concerned with their family, with their safety, with the kids' education, with their health care, all kinds of basic things. But to the extent that the bad guys can distract you with other kinds of, you know, extraneous issues, which really don't have much to do with your well-being, they succeed. And often people will tune out. So what we try and emphasize and show people that, guys, when something is going on, whether they're cutting your health care or pollution or so on, let's take that issue, and in that moment, here's how you take your message, amplify it, get it out there for free, emphasis being on free, because then you can harness that anger to get people to take an action like registering to vote or organizing or protesting.
Yeah.
That's the game's play.
I always say the wealth class has got all the money, but we've out-procreated them. There are more of us. If we just got our heads out of our, well, you know, out of the dark side of the moon, maybe we would actually get some things that the working class needs, deserves, earns, instead of all legislation seeming to benefit the handful at the expense of the many, which we saw with the one big beautiful nightmare bill that passed. We are literally, you know, the anti-Jesus Robin Hood in reverse bill. So for me, the idea of amplifying good messaging, creating that digital army of people, you know, sharing good positive stuff is enticing. But I look at the fact that, you know, the Democrats don't, and I know I'm going to get a bunch of emails saying, you're just beating up on poor Democrats. The Democrats haven't seemed to bought into the digital yet, have they?
You know, I've been doing this 8 years, and I agree with you. And I think this is, it's just sad. What happens is there's a certain establishment where they make money by doing things which are profitable for them. And in general, I'm speaking, it's not a universal, but a lot of political consultants make money buying TV ads. And TV ads are not the most effective solutions out there. So when you have a certain group of people who are motivated to keep doing stuff which makes them money, which may or may not help Democrats, it's a curse.
No, but look, you know, Deepak, you know, the reality is TV ads, in my view, and again, I'm a guy who's on TV, I think it would be better to take that money and pay people to stand on street corners with sandwich boards. I think that would be much more effective because at least you can get some interaction. Most people today just tune that stuff out.
I totally agree. The TV ads, you might as well just burn your money. But the thing is, there's ways to do it which are better than sandwich boards, but getting in front of people. But where I think what's important is, especially when activists and organizers who have no money, have very little technical skills, and have very little staffing, they need to be able to figure out a way to get heard, to reach more people. And the way I break it down is, for the time, effort, and money that you're spending on something, how many people are you reaching and persuading? And TV ads is probably the worst way to waste your money. And so there's smart ways to do it. And what we try and do on a day in, day out basis, literally twice a day, we write about examples, specific ways to do this. It's on our website. There's about 2,500 case studies. And the big thing here is, it's not about the money. You need to know what technology is available, especially the ones that are free, and how to use it.
Right.
That's what we try and do.
Well, and look, you know, with technology, you know, rapidly, you know, changing, and innovation coming almost daily, how does Democracy Labs balance that rapid technological speed forward with the need to build long-term movements and ensure that we have the digital tools to where we get activists and organizers together, even with people like me who may not be, well, the most tech savvy?
So the way we work is, number one, we do not sell any software. So that, you know, gives us the flexibility. When a better tool comes out, we'll use that one and recommend that instead. The other thing is, what I believe, my background is over 25 years in Silicon Valley. We'll work with activists. They'll say, how do we canvas better? How do we spread our message? How do we counter this disinformation? So the requests come in to us. We find the best solution available. We'll help them pro bono apply it. And then we share it on our website.
So in your view, Deepak, you know, what are the best issues for your model? Or are all issues the best issues? Are there some that resonate better? Any thoughts?
The issues that we believe are the most important are the, like, related to fundamental issues: healthcare, education, women's rights, gun violence. But here's the important thing, Rick, which is an issue. And this is part of the strategy of the bad guys. They want to distract you every 6 hours. There's some other news cycle going on. And they want, oh, watch this or watch that. What we try and do is say, guys, when the news is breaking, when they pass this big, ugly bill, let's kind of point out how it impacts you. Show people how it impacts their community, their families. And in that heat of the moment, drive them to take an action that volunteer with this group, go register here, and so on. The speed is essential to a, you know, a good response. That's how you kind of get some traction.
So how do you get, you know, people like me involved? Is this, I guess what I'm trying to get to is, how do we get people activated in this who may not be the most tech savvy? What are we growing new organizers? Is this solely about, we're going to go to an organization, we're going to show you the tools, and you're going to go out and get your activists, your organizers, your foot soldiers? How does this work for folks who are out there paying attention?
So all of us have certain issues that we believe strongly in. It might be women's rights or like the right to reproductive health. Whatever your issue is, you're only going to succeed to the extent that other people know about you, what the issue is, who the bad guys are, how they can get involved. In order to do that, you have to propagate your message, whether it's online or through canvassers or through petitions. The technology is secondary. It is a force multiplier, because if you had all the money and all the people in the world, you could do anything. You could go off and buy media outlets. But what we focus in on are the groups that have no money, no time, no skills, and very little staff. Let us show you how technology can help you reach more people with very little time and effort. And if we can do this, it makes them more successful and they have to waste less time on fundraising. And that's how we kind of fight back, because you can't outspend the big guys.
Right.
We have to work smarter.
No, you're definitely not going to outspend the billionaires who we keep funding. And this is the part that drives me crazy. They're killing us with our own money. And they're beating us with our own revenues. So I guess the last line of questioning I've got for you, and it's for the Democrats, because I beat up on the Democrats because I hope they should know better. I know Republicans are going to do every nasty, horrible thing that they're going to do. My hope is that Democrats are better. So if you had, you know, Schumer's ear or Jeffrey's ear, what are you telling them about, you know, how do we reach people?
I would say take a page out of the Republicans' book, which is innovate, get smarter, and have messaging discipline, which is, we need to be able to work smarter, not just raise more money and then waste it on TV ads. And for heaven's sake, like, you know, where people are motivated by how much they make out of a campaign, that's, you know, that's just terrible. We've got to innovate.
So are we in favor of campaign finance reform, caps, public funding? You know, are you in on any of that stuff, or is that someone else's deal?
That's way above my pay grade. But, you know, this thing about Citizens United, voter suppression, those are things which they've been kind of doing for years now, the Republicans. And so when that changes, I don't know. But the thing is, when people are being hurt, when they're losing their health care, when they're losing their food stamps, for heaven's sake, we need to kind of get people to pay attention to who's doing it, why they're doing it, and how they can get organized. And if in order to do that, it's going to be the, you know, the working people, like you said, the grassroots activists. And if we can help them in a small way to fight back harder using the right free technology tools, we will have served our purpose.
No, look, Deepak, I said on election night, and I've been saying ever since, the country has decided to go in this direction, and the solutions for the future are going to come from the suffering due to their savagery. That's been the line I've been using. Their savagery is apparent. You look at that bill they passed, you look at the cuts to Medicaid, food stamps, on down, there will be true suffering and there will be pain, and not just for the liberals and not just for Democrats, but for everyone in this country. And for me, the organizing that has to be done right now to bring those people in, to get us to the solutions we need down the road, what you do, I think, is incredibly important. So keep up the great work. I hope folks will check out the demlabs.org. We'll get links out on social media. But Deepak, I appreciate the time. Great work. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something you might be interested in, something you might want to organize around, something you might, I don't know, spend a little time on the internet talking to friends, neighbors. Want to hear your thoughts? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. As Wisconsin is brats on the grill for a tailgate, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. For tonight, we'll see a mostly cloudy sky, a little patchy fog out there, areas of smoke as well, a morning low with the lower 60s, a light southeast breeze. On Saturday, a few showers and storms, partly sunny skies, highs in the mid-80s. It's 75 at our studios.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I saw a phrase the other day that grabbed my attention. The idea that not a single person, one person, should never have the ability to destroy the planet. One person shouldn't have the power to drop the nuke, so to speak. We got a president who, he gets the urge, he gets the itch. He's already talked about, you know, nuking hurricanes. If the Epstein files, you know, if things like that get too hard, who knows what he's pressing? Or, you know, during the Reagan years, we were always concerned that Reagan might, you know, forget that it wasn't, you know, a call for ice cream and it was a nuclear bomb. And here to share some thoughts on maybe how we fix that. And maybe how we, well, in this age of rising tensions, kind of tap things down a bit. That's why I've asked Marty Perlmutter to come share some thoughts with us. Marty is the executive director of the Nuclear Disarmament Renewal at the Carpenter Institute for Progressive Democrats of America. Nukewise.org, the website. Marty, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure, Rick. So
that is quite a mouthful. Quite a mouthful indeed.
Let's shorten that. Let's tighten it up.
Absolutely. So let's start with some basic stuff. What is the Nuclear Disarmament Renewal Project there you're working on? And who's the Carpenter Institute of Progressive Democrats of America? Give me some basic stuff.
PDA is the reason we all know the name Sanders. You know, they put him on the map. And progressive Democrats do amazing things that concern all of us as, you know, working Americans. They have a educational 501c3 nonprofit that's nonpartisan, and its purpose is civic education. And the Carpenter Institute is an homage to the gentleman who founded PDA over a decade ago. And I'm honored to be running or initiating, we're giving birth to this thing, an organization that will put life back into the nuclear field, including information and policy advocacy and organizing.
Yeah, see, Marty, when I was a kid, this was a big deal. There was a lot of talker. There's a lot of energy around this last several years. Not so much, especially since Putin invaded Ukraine. The message has been just the opposite, not disarmament, but ramping up, because, you know, Putin showed that when you give up your nukes, some big behemoth's going to come in and take your cookies or That's- your country. So the messaging has been kind of on the other side of this. So do you see that as problematic or a reason to ramp this up?
Well, good question, Rick. So Ukraine had 4,000 nukes in the early 90s. They gave them up for a promise of respect for their territorial integrity and sovereignty. Oops. And the 4,000 nukes went back to Russia. Many of them got turned into diluted nuclear fuel, and others just got chopped up. The lesson is not lost on many countries, including South Korea, Japan, Germany, Poland, the United Arab Emirates, think of them as a nuclear power, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, South Africa, which once had nukes. There are many countries that are standing in line, scratching their heads, Lithuania, you know, saying, hey, what happens if you don't have these things? But the world is really quite different than it was when you and I were coming up. And though we've had nukes for 80 years, here's one fact that we could all look at. The United States today could disarm Russia and China both at the same time using non-nuclear weapons, using stealth technologies that we have and delivery systems that we possess, and they know it. So wait a minute, what am I saying? I'm saying that we don't need nukes to do the really serious stuff at this moment. And what does that mean? Nukes have become the weapons of the weak. North Korea, weak. Russia, at the moment, manifestly weak. China panicked about having non-parity. You know, under Mao Zedong, they only had 150 nukes. Now they're going to build 1,500 so that they have parity with the United States and Russia, and that'll create some interesting problems. Shortening this, deterrence seems to remain a fact. If somebody has nukes, it's unlikely that anybody's going to go right after them. On the other hand, they're militarily of very limited value, as is pretty evident from what's happened in Ukraine, right? So why do we have them? There are two classes of use of nuclear weapons that we talk about. Counterforce, which is when we bomb the Russian missile fields with nukes, and countervalue. Now, what does countervalue mean? That means holding populations hostage. And is that, like, okay? No, it's not okay. It's not okay ethically. It's not okay militarily. It's just a mutual assured destruction terror weapon. And my position that I'm suggesting to you is that the really sophisticated people who are looking at this stuff are scratching their heads and saying, why do we have these things?
Yeah. No, I mean, because you hit on a phrase that, you know, was my childhood, mutual assured destruction, mad, you know, we got to have this because they're ramping up, we have to ramp up so that they won't go first because it'll be, you know, the end for both of us. And there was an understanding of that. You're right. We don't live in that Cold War world anymore. And it's interesting that you bring up that we don't need them. Because for the average person, and look, I'm going to throw myself in the middle of that, I would rather have them than not, because if you've got them, I certainly want to be able to protect ourselves, myself and us. Make that argument, you know, of why it's okay for us to maybe tap down or do away with again, because I don't think people quite got that.
Okay, so Rick, you brought up the very first thing you said was sole authority. This is the putative power of the president alone to authorize the use of nuclear weapons. It has to be carried out. I mean, the president doesn't hit the button. What happens is a command is given to the strategic authorities, and the strategic weapons people further send the message down. It goes about five iterations down. Then somebody in a silo or in a submarine hits a button, and a whole bunch of permission links have to be synchronized in order to do this. It must be a lawful order. You can't say it's Tuesday and Melania and I had a terrible fight. Let's obliterate Isfahan in Iran. You can't do that. That's not allowed. I know we are in a phase where it seems that the law doesn't matter, but to military people, the law matters a lot, a lot. So sole authority, that's one thing. And then there's you know, a variety of other layers of thinking that need to be updated. You know, and obviously sole authority should be gotten rid of because it's ridiculous and it's a leftover from a time when there was no ability to communicate instantaneously, you know, using my cell phone. I could talk to everybody in Congress in 4 seconds and say, hey, should we blow the world up or not? So we could get rid of sole authority. First use, which is an American policy still, a leftover, real leftover of the 1960s, you know, which we needed, we thought, because the Russians had 5,000 tanks and we had 1,000 in Germany. And we were worried about the Russian tanks rolling through the so-called Fulda Gap into Bonn. And we said, okay, we're going to let you know, and we're going to have a policy that says that we can be the first to use nuclear weapons before anybody else does. Well, why do we have that now? And by the way, there is at this moment in time, one nuclear agreement in operation between the United States and Russia. It will time out next February, and then there'll be none. We have no negotiations or discussions with the Chinese. The Chinese have said, if you declare a policy of no first use, meaning we won't, the United States won't be the first to use nuclear weapons, we'll sit down with you and talk about our 1,550 nukes that we're building right now to put into those silos that we've dug in the Xinjiang desert. I think that would be a really nice thing to do. And if we had a policy of no first use, then I don't have to freak out about sole authority because I don't have to worry about Melania pissing off Don and us having a nuclear war on Tuesday.
Right. But, you know, here's the thing, and this is where my mind goes. Given this administration, given the people who control Congress, the Senate, the House, I have no faith that this is even something that they would consider, even with overwhelming popular support.
Absolutely correct. You're right. You're absolutely right. So here's what we're going to do. And this is why PDA and the Carpenter Institute and my efforts on their behalf may bear fruit and where we could use some intelligence from the audience here. And it's this. We're going to organize the best academic thinkers. We're going to talk to the best military and government figures in national security. And we're going to use the organizing ability, the manifest significant organizing ability of PDA to reach millions of people and educate them a little bit, like nukewise.org. That site is intended for Gen Z people to look at and wake up about the details of nuclear weapons, educate people to these issues, and then begin to mobilize them. This is not going to happen in 15 minutes, but it will happen in less than 15 months. We'll have people's attention. And in 15 months, we might have the beginnings of, well, a bit over 15 months, a different administration in terms of what's happening in Congress and certainly in the House. And then we can begin to talk about logical, sensible changes we could consider in our nuclear policies. And there are three or four things that we could go for. Get rid of the first use thing so we can talk to the Chinese. Rethink nuclear modernization, spending trillions of dollars. Even Trump agrees with this. It's stupid. The amount of money that is involved in modernizing nuclear weapons and sticking them on top of 50-year-old missiles inside those Minuteman, you know, silos, that's demented. Rethink whether we need three legs of our nuclear triad. I understand why that works out for Boeing and Raytheon and, you know, the other major defense contractors, but I don't see it necessary for the United States of America's right. Security.
And the third one?
Well, not modernize and get rid of the ground-based nuclear deterrent. Why the heck do we have that? And wouldn't that be an amazing thing? Just imagine Donald Trump, who wants the Nobel Prize, saunters up to the podium in 2 years at the United Nations in September, when all the world leaders gather, and says the United States today wishes to unilaterally declare that it's about to dismantle its ground-based nuclear forces. We're not asking anybody to do anything. We are, we hope, going to get some reciprocity by others, but hey, do what you want to do. We have over 700 thermonuclear weapons on our submarines that are still undetectable at any time. So we don't have to worry about our crappy missiles in the ground in Montana. And we're getting rid of them.
And then Marty Perlmutter would be the guy who would put Trump up for the Nobel Prize? Is that how that works? You know what?
If he did that and had a deal with the Chinese that we don't have now and renewed with Russia, I will go to Norway to be present and to applaud.
All right. But here's the thing, and this is where, we, as you were talking about this, I go, the military-industrial complex, they're going to lose their freaking minds, Marty.
No, they don't need to, because we need, you know, those Patriot missiles, those things. Each one of the missiles themselves is $1 million. The unit costs $1 billion. The Germans just 2 days ago announced they're going to send 5 of their Patriot systems to Ukraine, which is terrific because Zelensky needs 10 total. Norway has said they were going to send 1. I think the Dutch should send 1. The French will send 2. And boom, Zelensky's got his dream. And then he can shoot down those Zinzhal missiles, the supposedly hypersonic pieces of crap that rarely get through even now. He'll have enough Patriots to do it. That's going to still take a lot of money. And the Europeans have this thing going on where they're buying the stuff from American suppliers and then giving it to the Ukrainians. That's a workable system. We can live with that. And this war can be fought to a good defensive climax using that system. So, hey, if I'm Raytheon and I'm selling those Patriot, you know, resupply missiles at $1 million a piece, I'm a happy guy.
You're making your business. So then let me get to this, because, you know, most of the people that I know who are on the, you know, the getting rid of nukes bandwagon are also the anti-war folks. It doesn't sound like you're in that world. So how do you bring...
How do you square that?
How do you square that?
Look, I mean, war sucks. Come on. I mean, it's hideous. On the other hand, when Sherman said war is hell, what did he mean? He's not a poetic guy. He wasn't making some silly little observation. What he meant, and when he clarified this, is that war, when it is not prosecuted as hell, meaning if you don't press hard, and he burned his way across Georgia, then what happens is the war continues. Talk to the Israelis about how well that's worked out in Gaza. The war goes on, and more people die over time. You hit hard, you hit fast, and you end it quickly. War is hell. I don't advocate it, but when you're in it, there's a certain way to prosecute it.
No, I agreed with the Powell Doctrine. I agreed with, you know, you go in with overwhelming force, you try and make it as short as possible to attain your mission, your end goal. The important part is having an end goal, and that's
strategy. I mean, that's strategy. And, you know, here's the thing. I mean, you actually brought this up from the very beginning. We haven't had an end goal thinking, strategically for a long, long time in our nuclear posture and our nuclear strategy. You know, we just haven't thought about it. And I haven't seen an integration of the thinking about precision weapons and, robotic weapons and force delivered without reliance on, you know, these gross terror weapons, you know, which are not necessary. I mean, it's a hideous thing to say, but the United States can kill anybody on planet Earth within 3 hours, no matter where they are, no matter how deep the hole they're in. You know, ask Vlad the Impaler, ask Mr. Putin if that's not true. He'll tell you, yeah, they could. They really could.
But, you know, I listened to you, Marty, and sane, logical, rational. This is the kind of messaging that I want to hear around this issue. Because, look, I don't want to pass down to future generations the nightmare that we grew up in and worrying about the end of days and having to hide under Catholic school desks because we were told that's what saved us from the fallout of nuclear winter. I want to pass on something worth inheriting. So to hear that kind of rational positioning that you've got, I think could encourage a lot of people to come to your group to get around this issue. So if someone's out there going, hey, I like what Marty said, is there a way to get involved with what you're doing? Does your group, are you an organizing group? What do you do?
Yes. So through PDA, through Progressive Democrats of America, we'll have a website, a new website. I mean, you can communicate with me directly through that newquest.org site, but through this new site that's coming soon, you'll be able to communicate with us, to give us ideas, to indicate support, to give financial support. Modest, small amounts of money will go a long way in this domain, and to become engaged. And reciprocally, we're going to have all kinds of webinars, communications, media, you know, information about the area so that people get smart, quick about, you know, about nukes. Look, nobody wants to think about this stuff, and that's the problem. And it can kill us. You know, one nuke can ruin an entire weekend. And we need to get people re-engage, I mean, noodling about what is this stuff and why have we let it, you know, just wander for 80 years? And what are our options now? It's a very, very different world than it was in 1945, you know, and you know what we ought to do. I mean, should we spend a couple of $1 trillion modernizing our ground-based nuclear deterrent in those holes in Montana and North Dakota? Maybe that's really stupid. Maybe that's really stupid. Yeah. And the military industrial folks who we have to, you know, deal with, we have to, it's a real thing. They have plenty of toys that they can make that we need. And they'll be able to make their money without doing something that actually is turning out to be extremely difficult for them to do. In South Carolina, there's a plant where they're building pits. They're about this big. That's the core of the thermonuclear weapon, right? They've spent $9 billion on this plant so far. It's not functioning properly, right? And this is to modernize, to rebuild those nukes. We test those things. You know, not we don't blow them up anymore. You don't need to. You use supercomputers to do this stuff. But there are ways that we have of verifying the utility of what we got without doing awful stuff and without violating. There is a treaty. There are two treaties that exist still beyond what we have with Russia. There's the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is about to go down the toilet because there are going to be 8 new nuclear powers in 5 years. And there's an agreement not to test in the air that everybody but North Korea honors. We don't need to test anything, and we sure as hell don't need to modernize our ground-based nuclear deterrent.
Especially at a time when we're cutting SNAP programs and Medicaid and doing the anti-Jesus work. But Marty, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great discussion. Hope folks will check out the website, nukewise.org. Marty Perlmutter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Bless you.
Great talking with you. I want to hear your thoughts. Is this an issue that resonates? I know, look, when I go back to when I was a kid, this was kind of the big deal. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
This day in labor history, the year was 1898. That was the day that the United States Armed Forces invaded Puerto Rico. The invasion was part of the Spanish-American War. In 1898, the U.S. State Department noted, quote, "It seems to be conceded that every year we shall be confronted with an increasing surplus of manufactured goods for sale in foreign markets if American operatives and artisans are to be kept employed year-round." Many business leaders in the U.S. clamored for market expansion. At the time, Spain was still a colonial presence in the Caribbean and Pacific. When a revolution in Cuba sought to drive out the Spanish, in the United States, the drumbeats for war began to boom. Many saw this as an opportunity to expand the U.S. sphere of influence, although some labor leaders warned against war. One official from the Longshoremen's Union warned working people, quote, "If there is a war, you will furnish the corpses and the taxes, and others will get the glory." But soon labor leaders, including the president of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, got swept up in the war fever. In just a few months, the U.S. ousted the Spanish and became the colonial power in not only Puerto Rico, but also Guam and the Philippines, as well as Hawaii. This gave the United States footholds in the Caribbean and the Pacific. The small island of Puerto Rico remains a U.S. territory to this present day. Since the U.S. invasion, there have been movements for both Puerto Rican independence and also for full U.S. statehood. Today, the Puerto Rican people face a severe economic crisis, towering debt, and an unemployment rate more than double that of the United States. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Now, every time I think about what we just talked about with Marty, every time I think about, you know, war in general, or military spending and the enormous amount of money we spend on military, I think about Eisenhower. I think about the Eisenhower quotes that I learned about, you know, growing up, and the fact that, you know, as Eisenhower said, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. The world, he said, in arms is not spending money alone. It's spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. He said, this is not a way of life at all in any true sense. He said, under the cloud of war, it is humanity hanging on an iron cross. And in that same vein of humanity hanging from an iron cross, he goes on and enumerates, making one heavy bomber meant sacrificing 30 modern schools or two fully equipped hospitals or two electric power plants. He says, we pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed 8,000 people. He said, this is not a way of life in any true sense under the threat of the cloud of the threat of war. And to me, that's the reality. It's that opportunity cost. We're spending enormous sums of money on things that, I don't know, do we need to blow up the world 100 times? Wouldn't just one be enough? Because we can do it. And as Marty pointed out, we've got other capacities. Now, you may remember back in July 24th it was, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, they put out a report. Turns out we're now 7 years away from Social Security and Medicare running out of cash. And that means in 7 years, the benefit cuts will be 24% across the board, or nearly $18,100 a year for a retired couple. It's going to be me. And that's, 2033. So we're just right around the corner. And for healthcare, Medicare, there's going to be another 11% cut coming. So this is real folks getting really screwed. So when you look at the money that we could be spending on all this other stuff, we gave billionaires their money. Do we have to keep spending it? And understand, this was stuff that we worked for, we earned, and they're taking it after decades of people working their tail off. And yet now we've got some working class, some Trump supporters who are still cheering on those politicians who pushed through that one big, beautiful nightmare. That's going to make slashing Social Security happen faster. And again, expanding giveaways to the very wealthy. I find it interesting that people are waving the flag and cheering on the cuts to those people while retirement security for millions of people is being stolen right out from under them. And how does that make any sense? I mean, I think about my Republican friends who voted for this, knew this was what this was going to be. Supported, basically cutting your own throat because if they're going to go after someone else. We voted for policies that are going to make poor people worse off while ensuring that the trust fund babies, they are able to load their coffers easier. The wealthy keep getting huge tax breaks, more loopholes, and, the rest of us, not so much. And I think back to Trump, all the promises about keeping Social Security safe. Yeah, they were empty words then, and they're even more now. So if you're a working person cheering on the nonsense that's coming out of Trump world, ask yourself why you're betting against your own future. The cuts just don't hurt the rich because understand, they don't care about Social Security. They don't want Social Security. But retirees, people who are going into their golden years who need that, who planned on it, planned on the Medicare that's going to be part of that, the medicine they're going to have to buy, this is not good. This is not good for any of us. But again, we look at the policies that come out of D.C. We look at the policies that come out of our elected officials. We've got no problem giving trillions of dollars to the very wealthy. No problem giving trillions of dollars to the military-industrial complex. No problem giving trillions of dollars to those who already have trillions of dollars. And yet we're going to go after single moms, food stamps, Medicaid, and that what's left of our tattered social safety net. Seems like something wrong with that picture. Something very, very wrong in my view. In the most powerful country in the history of humanity, the wealthiest country in the history of humanity. I think we can do better, don't you? We should be demanding better. I know that. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you think this is right? Do you think it's sane, rational? Anything you heard today you want to get involved with? I want to hear your thoughts, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM, W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. The pathway toward any potential ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war has stalled. President Trump was asked today if he has given up on a potential ceasefire in Gaza. More from CBS's Charlie Daggett.
Hamas does not appear to be acting in good faith. That's the reason that Stephen Witkoff has given. Essentially, Hamas is not serious about reaching some sort of agreement. Now, there are some suggestions that Hamas is disputing details over, like, high-value prisoners exchange, which is a part of the deal.
The White House calls President Trump's trip to Scotland a working visit. It includes meetings with European officials and trips to two of his luxury golf courses. But CBS's Weijia Zhang in Scotland also reports
he is obviously trying to put an emphasis on what he's working on here in Scotland, potential trade deal with the EU, highlighting the trade deal that he signed.